Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have with us from Denver, Colorado, Nadia Boltz-Weber. Nadia, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. We are in the basement of the Boltz-Weber home. So thank you for letting us inside your house.
You're welcome.
Now, I've been looking forward to this podcast for a long time because I don't know if you know this, but in a lot of ways, we're the same person. We are church planners with Churches of Christ background. Mm-hmm. We both married someone from Texas. We both are over 5'10" tall, one a little bit more than the other. And we both like CrossFit.
Oh, do you CrossFit?
Yeah, I am. I'm a CrossFitter. So I feel like we have this strong connection.
I could spend the whole time talking about CrossFit. You know, all I did was watch Olympic weightlifting last weekend. I went to a meet. I wasn't competing in this one, but about five of my teammates were. And I watched Olympic weightlifting from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday and literally never got bored.
When did you get into Olympic lifting and CrossFit?
2.5 years ago.
How did that happen?
I have a herniated disc. I have a really bad back. And it was an attempt to avoid surgery. So I had to get, I became my own science experiment. Like, how strong can I get?
Okay. So when you have a back injury, you decide to pick up Olympic lifting, which typically people think causes back injuries.
Well, it was great for like 9 months just doing regular CrossFit with a little Oli lifting, but then I got obsessed with the Oli lifting. And then honestly, I overshot the benefits of strength training by clean and jerking like 150 pounds over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So it ends up my back doesn't like having 150 pounds held over it.
That's a shame.
But I still love it. I haven't totally given up, but I'm not competing this year. I qualified, you know, for nationals for masters weightlifting.
Did you really?
Yeah.
What's your go-to lift? Was it clean and jerk?
I can clean and jerk 150 pounds and then I can snatch. Well, we do kilos, 55. Is that 130 maybe?
I'm in Texas. I don't do kilos. I do pounds like an American would.
I know. I don't know. Whatever that is, maybe 130.
Okay. So here's the question. If you were told that the fate of preaching in America comes down to whoever can win a CrossFit WOD, which, by the way, is it sexist to call CrossFit workouts girls?
No, I don't think so. I think that's ridiculously oversensitive.
Okay, I'm allowed to say that. So if you have to pick one of the CrossFit girls, which if you don't know, that's one of the standard workouts of the day. They give them typically female names or sometimes their hero names. But regardless, you have to pick one workout and it comes down to the fate of American Christianity. They either have to listen to your sermons or Mark Driscoll sermons. Whoever wins the CrossFit workout of the day, what WOD are you going to pick?
Grace? Yeah.
Is that your favorite? Of course it is. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What's your PR?
I don't know. Here's the weird thing. I do like lifting really heavy stuff, but I'm not very competitive by nature with CrossFit itself. Mm-hmm. Like I'll push another girl in the gym to try and beat my score. Like I'll like yell at her until she lifts 1 kilo more than me.
Yeah. That's kind of the weird thing about CrossFit, right?
Yeah. And I don't really track my times as much. And so I don't know. I'm not that competitive when it comes to CrossFit. I just really like doing it. And I love being a great encourager of women. Most women are definitely stronger than they think they are. And I really like helping to convince them of that.
Why do you think most women don't realize how strong they are?
Well, I think we're socialized to be, you know, delicate flowers or something. Mm-hmm. And so so women just don't think of themselves as physically strong. And so a lot of times women will go into the gym and they'll be afraid to put weight on the bar, but I can look at them and know, look, you can definitely lift more than that. So I like encouraging them and seeing the satisfaction they get when they get their first pull up or when they do their first squat snatch or whatever. So
what is the way that you find to be the most effective to encourage girls compared to guys to lift heavier and do more than they think they could?
I don't know. Cause I never really, I'm really good friends with the guys in my gym, but I don't really focus. I don't really hang out with them during workouts. I really like being with the women. So I yell at them. I mean, I just scream and really like I scream encouragement. It's not like an, you know, army officer or something. So, you know, I scream at them until they finally get the bar up.
Nice. Now you were on sabbatical for the last 3 months. Were you working out while you were traveling?
Not very much, man. Mostly I was getting fat eating croissants.
Outstanding. What do you think is going to be?
I did CrossFit when I was traveling, but not with the regularity I do at home. So I didn't maintain my fitness by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. But over the 3 months, I did CrossFit in Istanbul, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Denver, New York, Belfast, Edinburgh, Brighton, and Glasgow.
Wow. I'm almost as impressed that you went to all those places as you remembered all those places.
It's fun traveling CrossFit.
What do you think is going to be harder, to get fully back into your Olympic lifting and CrossFit regimen, or getting back to preaching every week?
Oh, yeah. Well, CrossFit was rough to get back into, but I've been going 5 days a week since I got back a few weeks ago.
Okay.
And I preached day before yesterday for the first time. I was rusty, but I definitely have the experience of feeling like the Spirit intercedes with the sermons, you know. There's always a point where, I mean, every Tuesday when I look at the text, like this morning I woke up and looked at the text that I'm going to be preaching on, and without fail, I'm not kidding, every Tuesday I look at the text and I think, well, I've had a pretty good run, but now it's over.
This is your last sermon, you're done, no more good ideas, it's over.
I have nothing to say about this. And then I'll work really hard and put all these hours. I do put a lot of hours. I probably put about 15 hours of work into my little 10-minute sermons, you know. And then it always has to go through this process of me fighting and fighting and fighting, trying to say this one thing or trying to say six different things or, you know, all of that before eventually I sort of give up and pray and like, you got to hook me up with something or else I'm doomed. So, like, if you want your people to hear a word, then you better show up.
And so that, you literally have that thought the majority of times when you're preaching?
Yeah, no question. Yeah.
Have you ever had that feeling?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm not an overly confident preacher. So for whatever reason, I've never approached the process with a feeling of confidence.
Really?
It's a strange like neuroses or something, but every week I just think, wow, this my congregation's just going to be embarrassed for me when I preach this. After I preach it, like while I'm preaching it, it feels like the word. I am preaching the word. But yeah, up until that point, it feels like a pile of shit.
Really? Do you have like that fear, like it's not enough, it's not good enough, in like when you're writing or doing other things as well?
Yeah,
or
definitely when I'm writing. Yeah. So I don't know why that is. You know, I mentioned this on Twitter last week. You would think that my, you know, my book that came out last year doing well would bolster my confidence for writing the next book, but it's done the opposite.
Really?
So, yeah, sometimes I just feel like there's a lot. I have these weird expectations on me. Like people say some pretty big statements about me, which I find almost like upsetting. So,
give me an example. What's the most upsetting big thing someone has said about you?
Well, I don't know. Like there was that day the Daily Beast ran a front page article that said, "Can Nadia Boltzweber save liberal Christianity?" That basically made me want to go back to bed.
that's a lot to ask of anyone.
For, you know, whatever I'm sort of, you know, throwing down right now that people are picking up, I think they were just ready to pick something up like that, and then they sort of project things on me about, you know, being the hope of the church, or they'll make really, really bold statements about my preaching, or it feels like a lot to carry. Oh my gosh. Do you know that really famous YouTube video, Leave Britney Alone, where that gay kid he was like crying.
Yeah.
Doing like a selfie video.
Yes.
And he was crying because everyone was being mean to Britney. One of my parishioners is a drag queen, and he made one exactly like it called Leave Nadia Alone.
Are you serious?
Oh my God, you can find it on YouTube. And and he's like sitting there crying in bed, and he's like, "Can she resurrect liberal Christianity?" And he like starts crying, and he's like, "She's got massive shoulders, but they're not that big."
Oh, jeez. Oh, that is... Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous. Why do you think people project that on you? Why are they asking such a massive task for you to do?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that the church has always had the agape love of God and the gospel of Jesus Christ and this amazing message of grace and this incredible living into Christian freedom to offer that, and have consistently given people something else instead.
Hmm. Do you think it's something they've given leaders something else instead? Like what they're giving you as like this onus of carrying this weight? I mean, is that not grace? Is that what you're talking about? Or do you think it's just...
No, I mean, I think that people... here, they read what I write or they listen to a sermon, and I think that there's like this bell that rings inside them. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, they're like, this is what I hoped this was about. Like, inside me, I think the number one reason people leave church is because they fucking believe in church. You know what I mean? I think they believe in what it could be and what it could mean for them and for the world so much that they're like, I can't pretend that this is what that is.
Hmm.
So I think that a lot of people do have that desire to hear that, to hear some good news,
yeah,
some actual good news, you know? So, and just to be clear, I'm just a Lutheran preacher. This is just the shit I learned in seminary. You know, I mean, this is not even, I mean, it is, it's like law and gospel preaching is just, that's what you learn in Lutheran seminary. So yeah. I'm just doing what I was taught, really, and doing it as myself and not a sort of affectation of a preacher. You know what I mean? Like, and just that alone is what I think people are resonating with, but it's kind of simple.
Yeah. So people are leaving church because they believe in what church could be, and it's not in its present state what they think it could be, right? That's kind of your point? And
yeah, and I mean... Yeah, I think sometimes that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes the reason people can't be part of the congregations that they try and be part of is because they just believe too much in it to see, a lot of mainline Protestantism right now, you go to like a mainline Protestant church, it's like the Elks Club with Eucharist. It's not, I mean, do you know what I mean? You don't go in there. I mean, half the time I want to stand up in the middle of the liturgy and go, oh my God, what's the point? This is just, you know, I think we've sort of lost the plot.
Yeah. Hmm. That's interesting. Do you think your experience growing up, which was, like I said in the beginning of the show, I grew up in the Churches of Christ as well. You grew up in the Churches of Christ as well in the Colorado area. Obviously, that wasn't a good fit for you. And do you think some of the negative experience you had growing up in your church experience helps you connect with other people?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, we have a lot of sort of walking wounded post-evangelicals in my church.
Really?
But the thing I always say, which if you've ever listened to an interview, I always say the same thing, is that I
except I this one's going to be different.
Okay, this is different. I actually talked about CrossFit a lot more.
Good.
Which I'm sure your listeners are so grateful for.
Yeah, they're like, fast forward when they're going to stop talking about this. Olympic
you should really, when you post it, say, we actually start talking about like ministry and stuff at this point.
Okay, we'll say that. I'll put that in there.
Anyway, I try to preach from my scars and not my wounds. So I'm not hemorrhaging over that stuff anymore. And so I feel like I can access that and use it and talk about it. And it's not using the pulpit as a therapist couch, you know. Yeah.
Can you explain what you mean, the difference of a scar versus a wound?
Meaning, like, I can preach. I do put things in my sermons that can be painful for me, or that are inelegant things about myself, or stuff I struggle with, or hard things that have happened. If that is hard for me in the moment, meaning, like, if in some way I'm confessing that thing in order to make myself feel better, or something that's unprocessed, like unprocessed trauma or shame or whatever, then it's inappropriate because people can sense it. And if their reaction to hearing whatever I'm saying about myself in the sermon, if their reaction is to feel bad for me or feel shocked for me or feel whatever, then I should never have said that thing.
Yep.
If their reaction is, oh my gosh, if she can say that about herself, then like, if it's an invitation for them to access a truth like that for them, then I've done my work.
Yeah.
See? So
Yeah. There's something really interesting that that I saw online that you were, I think, down in Houston, and a gentleman from the Churches of Christ was at the event, and he stood up and made some sort of apology for the Churches of Christ and silencing your voice as a woman. And it seemed like it was a really powerful event. It kind of created a little bit of buzz on the old interwebs.
Yeah, that was amazing. I was unprepared for that, man. I'll tell you that. I mean, it was. I always do Q&A. It's easier for me to just do a bunch of Q&A than it is for me to talk to individuals after I speak. Like, talk when individuals line up to talk to me, it's super hard for me. I feel a little drained and a little vulnerable at the same time. So I try to just do a lot of really honest Q&A to if people have questions. So I was doing that, and this guy goes, you know, I'm so-and-so. I'm the preacher at the Church of Christ down the road, you know? And I was like, oh, here we go, right? And he goes, I just want to say that, like, I don't know if anyone's apologized to you for the fact that there was not a place for your amazing voice in our church, but if that hasn't happened, I want you to hear it from me. He said, I'm so sorry. And then he sits down. That's it.
Wow.
And I just immediately started tearing up, and through a very cracked, strained voice said, thank you. No one's ever said that. What? And I know I needed to hear it. And then I was like, and I think we'll break now.
On that, yeah.
Back after lunch.
first of all, well played on the break part right there. That was a good call on your part. Second of all, what made you tear up so much? What was so impactful about that to you?
I don't know. It was like, I didn't know I needed to hear it. And yet I think I did. You know, it's like, it was such a beautiful moment of grace and reconciliation, and it caught me off guard, you know.
Yeah.
So it was just, it was the real thing, and interestingly, on you know, if we're going to talk about Christian celebrity just for a minute, interestingly, I went, people knew, hey, I needed some space. Like, I usually I have to eat by myself if it's between talks. I go into this, like, sensory deprivation pod and in order to go back and give my next talk.
Yeah.
And I was sitting by myself, and my friend, one of my best friends, name is Sarah Miles. She sent me a link. It was either her or Rachel Held Evans, or maybe both of them, sent me a link to a blog from somebody who is very well thought of and came out of our same tradition. And who I think is great, but he wrote this post about Christian celebrity, and he goes, look, you know, people shouldn't be up in arms. There shouldn't be sort of ringing, you know, hand-wringing about the fact that there are people who sell books and are speakers in the church. He goes, if they're selling books and they're speakers, they probably are talented in some way. There's no reason to worry about that. He said, but this is how you know that they're really a celebrity and not just a public theologian. How accessible do they make themselves to individuals after they speak? Like, how, because if they say that they're introverts, that's like BS. They need to be available to whoever wants to have access to them. And like, I'm literally, I just started crying on stage. I have to give another keynote. I have 45 minutes, and I'm reading this going, like, alternating between like, I'm an asshole and he's an asshole, right? I I read it and I'm like, oh my God, I'm such an asshole. And I'm like, no, that guy's an asshole. And back and forth and back and forth. And I'm like, okay, last 10 minutes of the break, I'm done eating. I should go out into the narthex and make myself available to people. Okay, I'm going to do this. And I go out, and for 10 minutes, I'm not kidding, people lined up and took selfies with me.
Did that make you feel warm inside?
No, of course not. It's no. Like, who's making me a celebrity? Do you know what I mean? Like,
okay, first of all,
I try to be kind about the selfies. I allow people to do it, and I'm kind about it. It's not something I enjoy, and it makes me feel weird. I'm a Lutheran pastor in Denver. You know, I'm not. So, it was just it's hard to navigate all that. How to navigate all that stuff.
So. Yeah. Okay, first of all, Richard Beck is the one who wrote that post, and he's been on this podcast like 3 times.
Oh yeah,
he's a friend of mine, and we even had.
I think he's great. I was just like, here's the thing: I make myself available to my friends and my family and my parishioners, and I feel like the only thing I have left for anyone else is what I write and what I say from a stage. No. I don't have anything left. I mean, I can't pastor these people. They come up to me with, I literally don't have it. Mm-hmm. And so it's not because I think I'm a celebrity. It's because I'm a parish pastor and I have kids and I have friends. And like, I'm not, my capacity for interacting with individuals and being present and caring for them is not unlimited, yeah. You know? And I'm around thousands of people every year. Yeah. So it's really self-preservation because I feel like what's really of value is what I write and what I say from a stage. People think they're going to get something out of a personal interaction with me. They almost never get it. It's disappointing anyway. I'm not nearly as insightful or pastoral or whatever they're expecting. I'm not. And so... anyway, I understand it, but it was kind of like, oh, yeah. Come on.
Well, I actually had a friend of mine, Zach Lynn, who's the drummer of the band Jimmy World. Okay. He came on the podcast and kind of said the exact same thing that you just said, yeah. About Richard Spoh. So,
oh, wow.
Point well taken. You're not the only one who thinks that. Richard, we love you. You're welcome back on the show to respond anytime you want. But
I totally respect him. I do. Yeah.
No, I get where you're coming from. And to circle back to the Church of Christ thing, I hear that you're going to be at Pepperdine, your, I would say alma mater, but do you say alma mater after one semester or one year?
Yeah, I was there one trimester and really actually high the whole time. So I was kind of only vaguely there.
So you were, we'll call it like a pseudo-alma mater. Okay, how about that? But you're going to be a part of their Bible lecture coming back up in May. And so there is obviously some interaction you're having with your old tradition.
Yeah, which I never anticipated. So that's the first invitation I've had from a Church of Christ entity to be a speaker, and I'm really excited. You know, if someone told me 5 years ago, you know, you're going to circle back around and have relationships with people in the Church of Christ and have colleagues who are Church of Christ and be invited to speak, I'd be like, you're stoned. No way, man. There's no way. And so it's just this weird grace that it's like beautiful and slightly disconcerting how my book Pastrix has been received so well by conservatives.
Why do you think it has been well received by conservatives?
It's so funny. The funny thing is whenever they write a positive review, they always have to start with, we disagree on some really important issues, meaning the gays. I mean, it's like, so clear, the one most important issue of this day, right? So we disagree on some really important foundational issues of orthodoxy, gay people. And but then they go on to say other stuff. I think it's because I'm not actually a liberal when it comes down to it. I mean, I'm a really orthodox Lutheran theologian, and I think they sort of recognize the basic orthodoxy in my approach and respect, you know, the fact that I engage scripture so much. And I do have a really high Christology, and I think they resonate with that. So that's my guess. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting that you've kind of become friends with people you didn't expect to befriend. And I think recently you were talking about on Twitter, which it always makes me feel like a stalker to talk about what someone said on Twitter for some reason.
But that's what Twitter's for.
To stalk you, yeah. So I've been outside your house stalking you, virtually speaking, of course. So you're friends with Tullian. I have no clue how to say...
Tullian.
What is his last name? How do you say that?
Oh, God, I can't say his last name, but his first name's Tullian.
Yeah, okay. And so, side note, he might be the prettiest pastor in all of America, and he is very well-dressed. So he's in Miami, and he's...
But just to say something, I spoke to him on the phone. I was interacting with him on Twitter. I was emailing him way before I ever saw a picture of him, just to say, oh, God. I didn't know. And then I saw a picture. I was like, good Lord, is that allowed? Can you be a preacher and look like that? That doesn't feel right.
Well, I just feel uncomfortable right now. So I'm glad that you clarified that, though. I'm fine with me saying that now. Okay. So, but theologically, you guys probably aren't going to be reading a lot of the same books, but there is still a relationship there. And you talk about in your book the pirate Christian guy who befriends you. And so there's this weird tension of, in some ways, like, I don't mean to say you're the outsider, but in some ways you were kind of seen as an outsider. And now you're being welcomed and included by insiders, and I'd like to hear about that dynamic, because it also kind of played out in your church when you talked about how you were having the people from the suburbs with the khakis and the polo shirts coming in there. And so there's this weird dynamic of how, as an outsider, do you welcome into communion those who in some ways have been excluding you before? Not that our pretty pastor friend Tullian or anyone else was actually specifically doing that to you, but...
Yeah, no. Well, first of all, both with Private Christian and with Tullian, they're both, both of them are very, very compelled by the same, a lot of the same writers I am in theology.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, so we're all into Gerhard Ferdy. And I was, you know, one of my professors at Luther Seminary was a student of Ferdy. So we were you know, the three of us, while our ministries are demonstrated in very, very different ways, we still have, it's like we still have the same grandfather or something.
Oh,
right?
Okay. So there is a connection.
But the insider outsider, you know, sometimes at our church, we will open by saying, "Blessed be God, the Word, who came to his own and his own received him not. For in this way, God glorifies the stranger." Mm-hmm. So I think welcoming the stranger, when we talk about that idea of welcoming the stranger, that often, as I stated in my book, you know, for some of us, the stranger might look like your mom and dad, right? It mm-hmm. might be the suburban person with the Dockers. It's not always, you know, the homeless guy or whatever, right? Sometimes, if you're somebody who's kind of been an outsider, then sometimes that welcoming the stranger means welcoming someone who you perceive as being an insider. And then ultimately, those designations are actually meaningless. I mean, because you're coming around the table together, right? Mm-hmm. Every single person is coming to that table with the same hunger and the same need and is being fed with the same food. So the designation of insider-outsider is very much collapsed when you're in the face of the gospel and of the Eucharist. So,
do you think it's harder to go stereotypical outsider welcoming the insider, or the stereotypical insider welcoming back in the quote-unquote outsider?
No, I think it's the same sin. my reticence is the same sin as an insider's reticence.
Yeah. But,
I mean, I think that's why people want me to talk about that chapter so much when I'm speaking. I get a lot of questions about it because they recognize that's just the same sin. So, but what's hard for me about the fact that people remember that chapter so well is that people don't know what happened afterwards. Meaning, like, those people who I was having a hard time welcoming 2 years ago are essential members of our church. I mean, essential. Like, I can't imagine House for All Sinners and Saints without them. I can't imagine it. Hmm. So they're beloved part. They're a beloved part and essential part of our community. And so it's like people don't necessarily know the rest of the story.
Hmm. Well, one of the other stories you tell in the book that's about your church, which, by the way, great name.
Thanks.
That's a really good name. As someone who's come up with a church name before, I'm going, man, I wish I would have come up with that name. It's great. Well done.
Another church took it somewhere, I think in like Philadelphia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it's also accurate.
Yeah, I mean, it's House for All Sinners and Saints. Yeah, that's very fitting for what any church should be. So you tell a story about this failed rally day where you want to have a lot of people show up, and I think you had 26 people there. Mm-hmm. And you were in a funk, you were depressed about it. And then you go to a conference the next morning, I guess it's some Lutheran conference, and mm-hmm. you share the story about a failed ministry thing that you were doing. Mm-hmm. And somehow that connects with so many people. Why do you think that story of a quote-unquote failure, which I hate to call it a failure, I think you called it a failure, so mm-hmm. I'll call it a failure. But why do you think that connected so much with people?
Because sometimes the best thing we can do for each other is talk honestly about being wrong. And I think, and that is what has been missing a lot in the church. I think that there's been a lot of effort in pretending you're doing it right, pretending you're doing your marriage right, and your life right, and the church right, and that sort of smugness that you see in so much of Christianity. But that's not the reality people are living in the world, you know, in their lives. And the thing I've been saying a lot recently is like, man, people do a lot of pretending in their lives. Like, they have to pretend that they love everything about being a new mom. And they have to pretend that they're not smarter than their boss. And they have to, you know, I mean, there's just, and so why isn't the church like the one place where you can just lay that down? You don't have to pretend anything here. But what a lot of people have experienced is the church is upset. You have to pretend even more there, right? Mm. So I think having leadership that says, that is a little bit transparent and is willing to go, look, yeah, man, I made this mistake, or I was wrong about this thing, or here was something that didn't work well. It just invites other people into not having to hide those things about themselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think all leadership conferences in the church should include a panel of people talking about some of their biggest mistakes in ministry.
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, every single one. Not like, oh, one quirky one. I'm saying every single one should have that. Should talk, and sort of like, here's what happened. Here's why I was disappointed. Here's what I learned from it. Here's what I was trying to make happen because I'm an asshole, right? And whatever. Like, I just feel like I find those conversations super helpful. I mean, on Twitter, someone the other day said, hey, what's your new book about? I'm like, it's another collection of my personal humiliations for the general public's enrichment, basically.
Outstanding. Do
yeah,
you think
that?
Yeah, and I will look forward to reading that. Do you think this emphasis on, you know, authenticity when it's at the cost of your own pride and ego and just a brutal honesty, do you think that that was influenced by your time in the 12-step program?
Oh my gosh, of course. Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to pretend you have it all together when you're throwing up through your nose. Like, it's great.
That sounds really uncomfortable.
So, yeah, I mean, you're kind of you're really leveled out, a decimated human being that absolutely cannot function any longer when you're trying to get sober, right?
Yeah.
And so, and your capacity for getting better is very much related to your capacity for admitting the truth about that. Any kind of pretending, any kind of thing you try and hold on to, oh no, I think I can actually control this part of my life, or no, I think this wasn't as bad as it was. Any kind of that stuff, that gets in the way of you staying sober. So, yeah, there's no question. I mean, I've spent 22 years in those rooms, and I've listened to people talk honestly about themselves and their mistakes, and talk very honestly about God and prayer in the same breath, in a way that's like so real. They aren't trying to like impress each other necessarily. Well, sometimes they are. It's annoying. But mostly, if you're in those rooms listening to a bunch of drunk, you know, sober drunks talk about God and trying to control their lives and whatnot, it's real. That's pretty authentic. That's pretty transparent. And I find that so much more compelling than pretending to be a pious little shit and have like all of your, you know, just totally have it together and just be super smug. And, you know, the preacher up front with the smug sort of affectation of righteousness. I couldn't care less, man. I'm not even going to listen to what you say, you know?
How did you try to create that same sort of feel in your church that you've, you know, experienced in AA?
Well, I don't know that I tried. I didn't even realize the similarities until years after it started. So, here's the thing, anything really, I mean, it feels like a lot of the really awesome stuff at House for All Sinners and Saints was just happened, and it never happened because, boy, I really knew I was going to try and create it. You know what I mean? Like, it's a sort of byproduct, or it's a result of something that happened when I wasn't paying attention, or, I mean, it's very hard for me to, like, think, oh, well, here's my big project. I'm going to, for instance, if I had said, I'm going to start a praying church, and I put all the intention behind that, and I took all the steps I thought it would take, and I really, you know, hammered away at this. We're going to be a praying church. I don't know that we would be. You know what I mean? That wasn't my focus, and oh my gosh, is that a praying church? I mean, that's what God made them into, and it wasn't a result of my great project, you know? Same with the community, such an unbelievably strong community that shows up for each other. Oh my gosh, do they pastor each other and show up and give aid and love and food to each other. I mean, it's a thing to behold. Now, if I had started out thinking, you know, I'm going to try and create a community like it is now, if I started out thinking that's what I'm doing, there's no way it would happen. But I focused on word and sacrament. Like, that's the center of our lives together, is the gospel and the sacraments. And then all that other stuff just kind of happened as a result. I think we try to do things head on because we think too highly of our ability to succeed.
So you think a pastor should just focus on word and sacrament and let the body live out the other part of the church? Is that kind of?
Well, at least I do that. Should everyone else? I don't know. No. You know, people are like, what else goes on during the week in your church? I'm like, most of it, I don't even know. I mean, they're like doing it themselves. So there's a lot of self-generated stuff in the church. There's just permission to do that. I'm not going to do it.
You have this great line in your book that one of the job's main responsibilities of a pastor is addressing pain and tragedy. What do you think you mean by that? Obviously, word, sacrament, that's a big part of it, but also the responsibility of addressing pain and tragedy is the job of a pastor. What does it mean for a pastor to address those things?
Well, to me, that really is played out in the sermons. If I can figure out how to post on my blog anymore, I don't know how to do it, but I'm going to try and put it up today, the one I preach Sunday. So I pay attention to things that are hard in people's lives and in the world. And then I think, what is a proclamation? What is some good news given that, right? What can I say about God and how God operates and what God has promised us in light of a school shooting or someone in the middle of a divorce or whatever? So I just try and sew those things together as much as I can. I mean, if there's been a horrible tragedy happen, a school shooting or a hurricane or some huge loss of life, I feel like usually on Sundays, one of three things happens. One, nothing. You don't hear anything about it in your church, really. Or two, maybe the pastor downloaded some formal ass prayer off the denomination's website and just reads that, right? Or three, the pulpit becomes a soapbox for whatever political issue the pastor happens to be passionate about that's related to the tragedy. I just reject out of hand all three of these things. I don't find those to be pastoral. But I think that we do have something to say. I think that our Christian story, that the scriptures, that the liturgy, the tradition, the saints, there's always something that Christianity has to say about suffering and about pain. Our central image is the cross. Of course we have something to say about that, right? Yeah. And it's not hearts and rainbows and like unicorns and like coffee cups with inspirational verses on it. I mean, the sentimentality in Christianity I find singularly unhelpful.
How so?
It just feels absolutely meaningless in the face of actual life. So
how do churches get past that? I mean, how do churches get past that sentimentality, as you call it?
I don't know. I've never had to start with that and change it. Like, I don't have the experience of that, so I don't have much authority to say. I mean, one thing that that we do that I think other churches could do is, even if they're really large, there's a way to do it. But after the sermon, we have this time called open space, and it's like 10 minutes of prayer and reflection, quiet. Response. And one thing that happens during that time is that people write the prayers of the people, right, that are then read later in the liturgy. Whereas most churches download them off the denomination's website and read them, and everyone goes through their grocery list because it's boring, right? And so at church, you're hearing like, oh my gosh, someone in that room had a miscarriage this week, or there was somebody passed the bar, or whatever, right? Like, celebrate. So those are actually being spoken. People's prayers are being spoken. Two people gather all those prayers and read them out loud during the prayers of the people. So the truth about people's lives and what their longings are and what their fears are and what they're going through is spoken. So that space can hold it. And even if there's a large church, I did this at Festival of Homiletics. I just asked 12 people, I gave them index cards and pens. I said, after the sermon, could you write a prayer? Like, what do you want to say to God about yourself or the world or someone else in this moment? And then that's going to be read out loud. So then they really do become the prayers of the people, but without the sort of grandstanding or strain or the thing where like only the really extroverted people blurt them out loud, you know?
Yeah, that's a great idea. And you mentioned even large churches could do that. Your church, a couple hundred people, is that the,
On a Sunday, yeah. I mean, there's, I don't know, a few hundred people involved probably.
Okay, so if we were to take someone with your, and I don't want to say platform because Ian Cron went on a great rant about how awful the word platform is. So I'm going to say everything I can. Okay, but you have a a large footprint in the Christian community. Your book's done really well. Online presence is very large. If you were to compare that to someone from, you know, traditional evangelical church, and you would compare the size of their church to your church, it would be substantially larger than a couple hundred people. Fair to say?
Yeah, for sure.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think your platform is so large and a church that a lot of people, especially someone in Texas, would look at and go, a couple hundred people, that's just an average-sized church.
Yeah, that's a big church for Lutherans, though.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. I think having 200 on Sunday is probably larger than the average Lutheran attendance, mm-hmm. church attendance. I don't know, man. I wrote a book 5 or 6 years ago about Christian television. And in it, I was watching Joel Osteen. And this is when my church was struggling. It was like the first year. And man, we could not get like more than 35, 40 people. And I thought what was going on in that church was amazing. And I'm like, why aren't more people here? And then I'm watching TBN. I watched 24 consecutive hours of Trinity Broadcasting mm-hmm. Network and then wrote a book about the experience. And I'm watching Joel Osteen, it's like, oh my gosh, 35,000. Oh, in the book, I call him Mick Preachy. Mick Preachy. Anyway, it's like 35,000 people every Sunday. And I'm like, it was about, like, the popularity of someone like Joel Osteen is baffling to me. But then I realized the popularity of, like, American cheese is baffling to me. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't understand why someone would eat something that's not actually food. I don't understand why if someone has a lot of money, they'd buy a tract house in the suburbs. I don't understand why people dress poorly, right? There's so much I don't get that I'm baffled by that's mm-hmm. hugely popular that I think I should probably dwell on it.
So you just, okay, I don't understand just how it is. Don't understand people?
Why do masses of people want things that aren't real? They'll eat food that's not real. They'll hang art that's not real. They'll whatever. I don't know, man. I can't even venture to guess.
Does it bother you?
No, it doesn't bother me. No, I think the only reason it would bother me is if I thought, oh, if I had 2,000 people on Sunday, that would mean that the gospel's really alive here and that this I'm really successful. And I in no way have that as my standard. Like my big goal, I thought, man, if we could get 70 people on a Sunday, I feel like that would be huge. Like for years, I was like 70 people. So the fact that we have 200, I'm like, my church is, you know, it's massive.
Yeah. So how do you get past that sort of I'm a success because I have 2,000 people on Sunday mentality?
Oh, I don't know. I've never had that. I mean, I have struggles in my life. That's not one of them. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I had to overcome that idea. Mm-hmm. I've never cherished that idea. So,
why do you think you never cherish that? Because a lot of pastors typically do cherish that kind of stuff.
I don't know. I mean, I like how intimate our liturgy is and I like listening to people's prayers and like, I wouldn't give that up for some version of success I'm not interested in. Mm. Kind of like there's always every year for the past few years, there's been like when the synods are meeting in their assemblies in my denomination, there's always some clown who nominates me for bishop, you know? And so I'll get a call that's like, your name's on the first ecclesial. Of course, a lot of people's names are on these things, but whatever. So they go, you know, your name's on the first ecclesial ballot. So they call to see if you want your name to stay or if you want it taken off. Right. And I'm like, well, let me tell you how I hear this. Nadia, in exchange for a title you don't care about, we're prepared to give you a life in which you never have fun again. like, why would you want to be a bishop? That's awful.
Don't you get like a cool hat or something?
Yeah, a crozier and a mitre, I guess. But
the old mitre. I mean, that's a pretty nice honor.
Yeah, not interested.
Okay, so you're not interested in that. Okay,
I've had some weird offers this year. I mean,
like what kind of weird, you don't have to get in specifics, but what kind of,
like I was nominated to be president of this, of some seminary. I'm like, are you kidding? How bad would I be at that? What? Like fundraising dinners, like schmoozing your donors. Awful.
Well, okay. What would your best fundraising pitch be at a donor speech?
Like, don't be an asshole. Give us your money. Right. So, and then there were, I don't know, four or five production companies that were interested in I wish I was making this up, reality TV show.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, what, like Lutheran Duck Dynasty or like real lady pastors of Denver County?
I'm
like,
oh gosh. Oh no.
So I told my agent, don't even show me the emails. I just tell him no.
Okay. Well then I'm going to start working on a script for you because we can come up with something better. Cause I would watch the Nadia Meet Duck Dynasty reality show.
Well, the funniest part about that is if you actually knew me and you were like in my regular life, you'd know how completely boring a reality show about me would be. Like, first, it'd be like, this week, Pastor Nadia struggles to write a sermon, like every week, right? Mm-hmm. Or like, and I go to bed at 9 o'clock, you know? I mean, it's.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Not interesting.
Okay, well, how are you going to generate some good stories for your next book if you're going to bed at 9 o'clock and struggling to write a sermon every week? Are you going to have some good stories to tell too? Still?
Yeah, I'm almost done with the book. I just have a chapter and a half left. You know what? Shit just keeps happening to me. I don't... like, not...
My mom is going to listen to this podcast, and I'm going to get in huge trouble. I just want you to know that, so thank you.
You can bleep me out. I'm sorry.
I don't know how to do that, so we're not going to...
Like, for instance, I keep being wrong about things. Or, like, maybe not stories like, okay, I didn't get... conned by a pimp and prostitute like this time.
That's
or
a good story.
You know what I mean?
That's a good story.
My ex-convict boyfriend isn't coming, you know, to visit me anymore. Whatever. So I mean, obviously I'm not telling stories about my past so much, but there's been enough that's happened in just in my parish in the last 2 years that I think there's enough to talk about.
Are they letting you tell stories about them in your book?
I haven't asked yet. Hopefully. I had permission from the other people who I wrote about for Pastrix, but that process kind of happens later.
You could probably put something in like the signing to be a member of the church, like your doctrinal belief statement or something. Like I am willing. Release. Yeah. It's a release form. Really. It's all it is. Hey, Nadia, thank you so much for your time. This has been a lot of fun. And obviously your book, Pastrix, is that, am I saying? I can't pronounce a book. Okay, I don't even understand the title. I know it's someone made fun of you about it, and like that was supposed to be a derogatory term, but
yeah.
I don't get it. Like, what? How is that making fun of
you?
It was
like a fake Latin female form of pastor, because they wouldn't call me pastor because I'm a girl. So they made up Pastrix.
Pastrix.
Because they didn't think I should be a pastor because I'm a girl.
Oh, snap, you're a pastrix. I don't get it. I don't get it.
No, I know, it's stupid. And then... that's what I titled my memoir, so I think I win.
Yeah, you win. You got a book out of it, and well done. So the next book is going to be just a sequel, Pastrix 2. I can't even pronounce it.
Pastrix. I don't have a title. It's much more about my church than the first book was.
Okay. Well, if you ever get on Duck Dynasty, let me know. I look forward to watching that episode. Otherwise, thanks for your time, Nadia.
You too. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.